the monthly K-Boom movie night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, reports of Russian troops in the Ukraine meet with warning by President Obama of consequences.
Portland teachers have ratified the contract bill they agreed to with the Portland Public Schools Administration.
Ibrahim Mubarak, founder of the Right to Dream 2, was arrested last night while observing Portland police perform homeless sweeps.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 28th, 2014. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Last night, Portland police arrested Ibrahim Mubarak under the Burnside Bridge. Mubarak co-founded Right to Dream 2, the rest area for people who are houseless and have nowhere to go. Right to Dream 2 received a gift of over $800,000 to help find a permanent place for the houseless resource, whose tagline is the right to rest, the right to sleep, and the right to dream too. Police were under the west side of Burnside Bridge to enforce private property trespass laws in a parking lot. Mubarak and about 10 others were there to witness police behavior as they rousted people sleeping under the bridge from a parking lot to a strip of sidewalk. Video captured police explaining that they were only interested in removing people sleeping in the lot, not the people sleeping on the public sidewalk. KBOO reporter Kristen Yount spoke with alias Dick Weed about the police action.
This is Kristen Yount in front of MCDC reporting for KBOO News. I'm here with Dick Weed, who happened to be under the Burnside Bridge last night and at the scene of some pretty serious police activity resulting in one person getting arrested. Want to tell me about that?
Hi, so I'm Dick Weed. I'm with Right to Survive. So I was with Ibrahim Mubarak. We were down there just to get some video and an idea of what the houseless community has to go through in order to, to participate under the bridge and sleep there. It's pretty horrendous. They've got the entire population of the houseless people there on a narrow stretch of walkway, which apparently is okay for them to sleep on. But they made the entire parking lot illegal to step on. During the time that I was there for about 3 hours, and I taped over 70 to 80 regular Joes cruising through the parking lot and not being harassed at all. And then it's like a bell went off, and it was time to harass the homeless because they were the majority of people down there. So that's when they swooped in. They brought in about... So they brought in about 4 police cars and, of course, the Pacific Patrol, which is the security for the building. The White Stag building is the ones who are claiming to own the parking lot. And they swooped in and they started issuing warnings and citations and an exclusion. And, of course, you know, we don't want to give them our information because we're exercising our rights and we haven't done anything wrong. We're not being criminals. All of us gave him fake names, and sadly, it was Ibrahim. Out of the 6 of us, who were mostly white, Ibrahim, who happens to be black and Muslim, was the only one that was arrested, although we did all the exact same thing. I was within 10 feet of him doing nonsense. I told the officer that I was Rasputin. I had to spell it out for him. gave my date of birth as 1634. I don't think that's accurate, but it sounded good. I don't know if it's policy for the white cops, and they were all white, every white as the day is blue today. What a beautiful day. And I don't know if that is the majority of their makeup, or if their policies really did say, you know what, the guy with the shiny tooth, that's the guy we have to arrest today. Personally, I felt really slighted that even though I was being completely ridiculous and deserved to be arrested, I couldn't get arrested. And as a white middle-aged man with my privilege, I was really ashamed.
Do you think that the city is coming down on Ibrahim for his recent win, or could be conceived of as a win for R2-D2?
No way.
You don't think it was on purpose that they arrested him?
No way. It was a complete and total mistake.
You think so?
By really ignorant cops. Of course it was. If they knew who they were. Hey, who wants to take on Ibrahim?
You think that's why he got out so early?
Of course. I think they really stubbed their toe. I mean, if you really wanted to piss off somebody who could absolutely have 5,000 people show up and party under that bridge. By the way, I'm inviting the entire community. I don't care how much money you make or whatever. Come down and have music and drinks with us. I think we should party there until the white stack crumbles.
Right on. Well, this is Kristen Yelt reporting for KBOO News. We're talking to Dickweed. He didn't get arrested last night, although he definitely should have been.
Definitely.
Awesome.
Wasn't through.
Last Tuesday, the Portland Association of Teachers and Portland Public Schools reached an agreement to avoid a strike among the area's 48,000 teachers. The new contract stipulates hiring more teachers, raising salaries, and reducing class sizes. Yesterday, union members ratified the agreement. KBOO reporter Ryan Katz has more.
Yesterday, the Portland Association of Teachers ratified an agreement that was previously reached with the Portland Public Schools to avoid a potential teacher strike. Under the contract's terms, Portland Public Schools has agreed to hire 150 more teachers, add 2 to 3 more days to the school year, and give teachers a 2.3% annual raise for the next 3 years. Gwen Sullivan is the president of the Portland Association of Teachers. She says that going into the negotiations, teachers were motivated by a few different factors.
For us, it really is about being able to better meet the needs of individual kids. And so there are many things, obstacles that have gotten in the way to be able to do that. One, I would say, with class sizes being so enormous, the individual attention that you are able to give kids that they really need to succeed has diminished. And so one is to get more teachers on the ground working with kids. Two, I would say that a lot of why we got into teaching in the first place has been taken away from us, and we feel like we've been forced to, in some ways, to teach to a test rather than to help kids reach their full potential. You know, we wanted some protections about some academic freedom and protections around the use of standardized tests. I would say the other part of it is just being fairly compensated. People don't expect in this job in the first place to make a lot of money, but they want to be fairly compensated.
Sullivan says that when negotiations started in April of last year, things got off to a bit of a rocky start.
From the start, they were about gutting our contract, about taking away rights, and really limiting our ability to do our work. They walked through timelines of the shortest amount the law would allow and just kind of pushing through this without even really negotiating and talking with us. It's been pretty aggressive from the beginning, but we got to this point where our teachers, they felt really disrespected. They just wanted to work with students and do their job and felt like they weren't being listened to. You know, more and more parents and teachers got involved and the community got involved. And I think that we got to the point we are now. We avoided the strike because of our strong commitment from our community, parents, and students.
And after a 23-hour bargaining session, the two sides came to an agreement last Tuesday.
the language that is in that contract is the district shall hire next year a minimum of 150 teachers, which is huge. We retained some workload language that the district was trying to get rid of, and then we added language around putting together a workload committee that talks about everything from how many students you have in a classroom to how many initiatives are you being told that you have to do. I mean, a variety of things.
Going forward, Sullivan hopes that this deal will begin to address the race and class achievement gaps, as well as focus on priority schools.
Some of our contract language addressed kids in poverty and in our minority students and families. And I will say that we were the one that put in that all of our focus and priority schools, which tend to be our black and brown students, that we wanted to make sure that they had more help, not less. And so we proposed to add 3 to 5 additional school days to the year. And in this contract, the district may add 3 additional days to priority and focus schools. And then I will also say that there are changes with our academic freedom where we don't have to teach to a test, that we can actually start to modify our instruction to make sure that we are addressing our very unique culture and background of the kids in the city. And so to be able to have more culturally relevant practice is really a win for all of us.
And although this might be put in the win column, Sullivan says the work is just beginning.
I would definitely say that it is a strong first step in exactly what we set out to do. You know, that we were fighting for the schools our students deserve. This fight is far from over, but it is a strong first step.
On Monday night, school board members are expected to approve the proposal, which will end any threat of a teacher's strike. For KBOO News, this is Ryan Katz.
A private contractor with the Department of Energy has found significant flaws in the new generation of holding tanks at the Hanford Nuclear Waste Site. Single-wall tanks at the site date back to the 40s and contain radioactive plutonium from the production of nuclear weapons. Many of these tanks have been leaking for years, and a plan is currently underway to transfer the waste to newer, double-wall tanks. This more recent batch of tanks from the 60s and 70s was thought to be safe until 2012, when the first double wall tank began to leak. Now a study has shown that over half of these tanks have construction design flaws that will compromise their functionality. This week, Senator Wyden demanded the Department of Energy build a new fleet of tanks that will better withstand the test of time. The estimated cost of these tanks would be $100 million each, but the citizen watchdog group Hanford Challenge says that it will be cheaper in the long run to make sure the waste is secure rather than pay exorbitant fees to clean up leakage.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight we hear from Chris Reiser and Kip Kruger about how North Portland's gentrification has affected the African-American community and the hip-hop scene. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. This weekend's weather will be slightly rainy, with temperatures on Saturday in the upper 30s and on Sunday in the low 40s. Sunrise at 6:50 a.m. and sunset at 6 p.m. On this day in 1935, nylon was invented by a chemist at DuPont. In 1993, federal agents raided the Branch Davidian headquarters in Waco, Texas, initiating a 51-day standoff. And exactly 1 year ago, Pope Benedict resigned, becoming the first pope ever to do so. Today's quote, Khalil Gibran said, "Beauty is eternity staring at itself in the mirror, but you are eternity, and you are the mirror."
It's 5:19. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
From the Gatling gun to the nuclear bomb, from hot air balloons to drones, the military has enlisted scientists to develop ever more effective war technologies. But now comes a long-sought scientific breakthrough that the military brass considers the ultimate advantage for battlefield effectiveness. Ready-to-eat pizzas. With the spare-no-expense determination usually associated with something like the Manhattan Project, teams of the best scientific minds at the U.S. Army Natick Soldier Research and Engineering Center have been focused intently on this secret pizza project. It seems that the combat troops have been asking, even begging, that the individual field rations they get, called meals ready to eat, include pizza. Not easily done, however. MREs are prepackaged, shipped to faraway combat zones, and stored for months. Problem is that the sauce, cheese, and toppings of pizza contain moisture that turns the dough soggy, allowing bacteria to grow, spoil the pie, and poison the eaters. Using humectants, food engineers were able to stop the moisture from reaching the dough, but that was not the end of it, for the Army was gunning for the holy grail of MREs, a prepackaged pizza that could be stored in 80-degree heat without refrigeration for 3 years and still be fresh. At last, the scientists have announced VP Day. By adding acid to the ingredients and iron filings to the packaging, science has triumphed over nature, delivering a pizza that's literally for the ages. This is Jim Hightower saying, perhaps you're wondering about taste. Well, picky. After 3 years, the crust is not exactly crisp, and the things are not served hot, so these are hardly the pies of Mario Batali. However, Mario doesn't do battlefield deliveries. But wait, that could be a good use of drones.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
A youth movement has sprung up around the country to oppose the planned Keystone XL pipeline. This weekend, these groups will converge on Washington, D.C. to fight against the environmental impacts the pipeline will cause. KABU reporter Keegan Herron spoke with Ali Johnson Kirst, one of the organizers of the campaign to stop the pipeline.
First off, can you just give me the basics about the Keystone XL protest that's planned for this weekend at the White House?
Sure. So we're going to be meeting up tomorrow during the day to have a divestment meetup, because a lot of the students who are coming down are working on divestment campaigns at their colleges. Then we're going to be having a nonviolent direct action training in the evening for those who will be risking arrest on Sunday. Then on Sunday, we're meeting at 10 a.m. to march from Georgetown University to Lafayette Park, where we're going to have a rally featuring a number of frontline speakers and youth voices. And then we're going to be doing a human oil spill in front of the White House, chaining ourselves to the White House fence. Students will risk arrest. So to say to President Obama, you know, you wouldn't want an oil spill in your backyard. Don't put this in someone else's.
And who's organizing this protest?
This protest is youth organized, and there are a number of different levels of organizers. So there are four core organizers, and then we have a core team of about 20 young people who have done, have worked on working groups for everything from planning the rally to fundraising to organizing buses. And then we have a campus point person level who have done an incredible amount of work doing recruitment and fundraising as well to actually get young people to come out.
And why do you see it as important that youth are taking the lead on this issue?
So we are, we're going to be seeing the direct impact of the decisions that are made on issues like the Keystone XL pipeline and other pipelines around the world. We are going to be bearing the brunt of those impacts.
So I heard the State Department was investigating the outside contractor that was hired to assess the environmental impact, and on Wednesday it ruled that there was no conflict of interest. How will that affect the project?
So the Environmental Resource Management Group that reviewed the pipeline has worked for TransCanada in the past and lied about the fact. They actually said on their application to be the group to review the pipeline that they hadn't done that, that they hadn't worked for TransCanada in the past, which just isn't true. They continue to have connections to TransCanada, and they're a dues-paying member of the American Petroleum Institute. As young people, we find that unacceptable, and we need to separate the fossil fuel industry from those regulating the fossil fuel industry. The Environmental Resource Management Group does not fulfill that.
What do you see as the most pressing environmental concerns for the pipeline?
It goes from everything from extraction, where the First Nations boreal forests, their livelihood is being cut down and poisoned, killing, you know, their fish, killing their caribou that they rely on. Everything from up in Canada, that piece of the destruction, to, you know, running the pipeline through the America's heartland, where we're seeing, you know, spills that are destroying farmlands and you know, aquifers, and then down in the Gulf Coast, where we're having refining, you know, pollution from refining that's causing incredible amounts of health issues, like increased rates of asthma, off the chart cancer in those communities, primarily communities of color and low income communities that are bearing the brunt of this pipeline, and that are traditionally bear the brunt of environmental degradation. Those are some of the big issues that we see with this pipeline.
Thank you, Allie. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I'm very excited for this action. I think that there is an incredible amount of hope and excitement among young people, and I'd like to share that with you now. We're on the bus down to Washington, D.C. from Vermont right now. I have a whole busload of young people who and those standing in solidarity with us. Some older folks are going to join us for the march, and they're excited to give a shout out.
I've been speaking with Allie Johnson-Kirst. This is Keegan Heron with KBOO News.
Yesterday, Isabel Allende was chosen to lead Chile's Senate. She'll be the first woman to hold the position. She'll start on March 11th. Isabel Allende is best known for her prolific magical realism novels that have won worldwide acclaim. She was first elected to public office in 1998, and for the next 12 years co-authored bills in the Chilean legislature that legalized divorce and criminalized domestic violence. She has also pledged to fight for women's reproductive rights. Chile remains one of only six nations that ban all forms of abortion. Her father, Salvador Allende, held the same position from 1966 until 1969 before being elected president in 1970. In 1973, Allende committed suicide rather than surrender to the coup led by the military general Augusto Pinochet, which would rule Chile for almost 20 years afterward.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ryan Katz, Tim Nakayama, Diablo, Terry Palusi, Carl Fisher, and the producer is Keegan Heron. Our engineer is Ian Gedberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott speak with Dina Pierrot, a social entrepreneur and community advocate with businesses centered around diversity, equity, and inclusion. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Bill Resnick talks with Mark Weisbrot about the situation in Ukraine. The Movie Moles discuss the documentary Orgasm Inc., The Science of Female Pleasure. Joe Clement talks with Jacobin magazine editor Peter Fraze about redefining work. And Jan Hocken interviews creator-producer Madeline Burroughs from Mom, Baby, God, an abortion rights performance coming to Portland. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus, a weekly interview show about our place on the planet. At 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman speaks with science writer Judy Foreman about her book, A Nation in Pain. And at 11:30, it's Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Come to KBOO's open house tomorrow from 1 to 4 to celebrate. And now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses. Tonight we hear from Chris Reiser and Kip Kruger about how North Portland's gentrification has affected the African-American community and the hip-hop scene. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Liam.
I just wanna take a little time out. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh wait. Thank you.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's winter membership drive. It was a success. And we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your cat, for your
cat. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the PDX Fusion Winter Event, Words. Words will take place Saturday, March 8th at 8:30 p.m. at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne. PDX Fusion celebrates the collaboration between different modalities of expression. Words will feature multiple different performers, visual and interactive art, and a short presentation on creating social change through body-centered communication. That's Words, hosted by PDX Fusion, on Saturday, March 8th at the Analog Cafe. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, glowing U.S. coverage of President Enrique Peña Nieto has some folks buzzing about the Mexican moment. But is privatizing the oil industry really the reform it's made out to be? We'll talk it over with independent journalist Shannon Young. Also on the show, the Associated Press won a Pulitzer for reporting that the New York Police Department was spying on Muslims in mosques, bookstores, restaurants, and elsewhere, simply because they're Muslim. Now a federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit over that spying, saying any harm wasn't caused by the NYPD, but by AP. We'll talk to Ashley Gorski of the ACLU about what that ruling means for civil liberties and journalism. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
After a decade of fighting two ground wars, it might not come as a big surprise that, for a number of reasons, the U.S. military might start to shrink. Nonetheless, news that the Pentagon would be making a budget recommendation that included a reduction in the size of the armed forces led to some panicky media coverage. Take ABC Pentagon correspondent Martha Raddatz. Her February 24th report stressed that a fighting force of 440,000 would be smaller than it was before World War II and Vietnam. She added that critics say the cuts signal a weakness and an opportunity to future enemies. As if that weren't scary enough, she went on.
But here is one haunting thought, Diane. A recently retired general told me today he worries about slashing the number of troops. He said he remembers the day before 9/11 when he held in his hand a recommendation to cut America's troops. Of course, that is a cut, Diane, that never happened.
So last time there was talk of reducing troop levels, there was a terrorist attack. Why mention that and not, say, refer to troop reductions in the early 1990s? Why not mention the size of the U.S. military budget relative to the rest of the world? Why not mention, as some other reporters did, that this new budget request actually calls for spending increases in the near future? Maybe because that wouldn't have the desired effect.
The Obama administration announced that it was giving up, for now anyway, the idea of cutting Social Security benefits with an inflation accounting adjustment known as a chained CPI. Social Security cuts, as we've noted often, are enormously unpopular with the public, but are considered the wisest or only possible course by the media elite. No surprise, then, to hear the decision bemoaned as a huge disappointment on the Washington Post editorial page, which declared that Obama, quote, has abdicated what little leadership on entitlement reform he had shown, close quote. You could almost hear Post columnist Fred Hyatt sigh